Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
At this time yesterday, it was still a what-if conversation. Now, life with 59 votes is a reality for Democrats in the Senate. So today on the broadcast, the economics of 60-1. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday today, the 20th of January. Good to have you with us, as always. I would be willing to bet a substantial amount of money that this is not the way President Obama thought he would be marking his first year in office, with the loss of a vote in the Senate and the ensuing reexamination of what it is that he wants to get done this year. To explore that topic a little bit, we've called Thomas Mann. He is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Tom, it's good to have you with us.
Happy to be with you.
So I'll tell you what, let's skip healthcare because everybody's talking about that and go on to some of the other particulars of the Democratic agenda in Congress and see how they might get that done. First of all, financial reform legislation. How's that going to happen?
Well, we've already seen signs of bipartisan cooperation on the Senate Banking Committee. Senators Dodd and Shelby agreed to set up a process in which pairs of senators, one Democrat, one Republican, have been dealing with components of the bill. And fact is, it would be hard to hold all 60 members of the Democratic caucus together on financial reform if you had no Republican votes. So in reality, I don't think the loss of that one seat will materially affect the outcome of financial reform.
All right, moving on to some of the other things that the president and Democrats in Congress said they wanted to get done. The House has already approved a climate change bill, the energy bill. It's got the cap and trade mechanism in it. What about the prospects for that in the Senate?
Not good, but listen, this is a tough measure to pass with the supermajority in the Senate during times of great economic distress. Odds are it wasn't going to pass before the election. It probably is not going to pass after.
What about a jobs bill or some kind of another stimulus package?
Well, that gets more interesting. I have no doubt that Obama and the Democrats will press forward with the jobs bill. And they will dare the Republicans to filibuster that bill. So in the end, Republicans may defect from their party, their united opposition to anything on the Obama agenda, and they may be able to pass that bill in spite of having lost one Democratic seat.
Well, that gets us back to the Massachusetts election from yesterday. It was all the economy, stupid, wasn't it?
It wasn't just that, but it was a big part of it. I'd say the public anger, fear, skepticism, distrust, concern, anxiety, all of that not about ideological positioning, overreaching by the Obama administration. So much of that talk that I've heard and read today is I think, largely beside the point.
There is, of course, a lot that can happen between now and November. But do you think that economic feeling is going to continue through to the midterm elections?
Oh, I think it will be the driving force. We're not going to much remember what happened in Massachusetts in January come November. It will be the economic conditions as they exist in the couple of months and weeks leading up to that election.
Thomas Mann, he's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington. Tom, thanks a lot.
Happy to be with you.
We got a listener email earlier today that said, tongue-in-cheek, I think, that the guy can't wait to hear a story about the stock market tanking because of Scott Brown's win in Massachusetts. And the markets did indeed have a rough day. The Dow was off more than 200 points early on. IBM was down, as were Alcoa and Caterpillar and Kraft Foods and all the rest. And we'll have more on that later, as we always do. But here's the thing. I don't think any of it had much to do at all with politics. We asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth what was really going on.
The short answer is China. The Chinese government's reportedly been telling big banks to stop lending so much. Ori Landesman is head of global growth at ING Investment Management. He says the rumor is there'll be less lending overall in China this year.
That got people concerned that China might be trying to put the brakes on the economy, which conceivably could have a deleterious effect on demand for commodities and even some finished goods as well.
But it's not just China. IBM posted lousy earnings late yesterday, and today Morgan Stanley said it lost more than $900 million last quarter. Richard Sparks is an equities analyst at Schaefer's Investment Research. He says investors also didn't like what the Commerce Department had to say. It reported some disappointing housing numbers.
The economic recovery currently is fragile, so anything that might suggest that it's not moving along nicely could spook the markets a bit.
There could be more bumps tomorrow. Analysts have high hopes for Goldman Sachs and Google's earnings. They're less convinced about Continental Airlines and Xerox. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
So as I said, not so good a day at the corner of Wall Street and Broad in Lower Manhattan. Better than it could have been, though. And we'll have the details when we do the numbers. From the always interesting world of the American housing market, this dispatch today. As Elisa mentioned, housing starts fell unexpectedly last month. That is, the number of new residential construction projects went down about 4%. Perhaps a sign of unease among contractors and building companies. In that vein, the Federal Housing Administration has announced that it is going to toughen up on the requirements for the residential loans that it insures. Could be painful for the housing market in the short term, but better for the rest of us eventually. From Washington, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
The Federal Housing Administration doesn't make loans, it insures them. And now the FHA is giving homebuyers a little tough love. Consumers with bad credit who want FHA-insured mortgages will have to come up with down payments of at least 10%. They'll also have to pay higher premiums for FHA mortgage insurance. Lou Barnes is a mortgage banker in Boulder, Colorado. He says this will force banks that offer mortgages backed by the FHA to be more picky about who gets a loan.
This will shut off credit access to consumers who theoretically fit the rule book or might be jammed into the rule book, but who really shouldn't become homeowners.
And those consumers who do get an FHA-backed loan will have to pay more. The FHA is raising the cost of mortgages just as the housing market is trying to get back on its feet. But housing analyst Karen Petrou of Federal Financial Analytics says it's the only way.
We need the FHA to be a prudent part of a recovering mortgage finance system. There's no easy way out, but prudence should dictate policy now.
And the FHA is in a position to dictate. It now insures more than a third of all new home loans. David Barenbaum is with the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. He says the FHA isn't inflicting a lot of pain. It's just weeding out risky borrowers.
I think they've found a middle-of-the-road approach that will work for most borrowers.
It will work for the FHA, too. The higher premiums will go towards shoring up the FHA's reserves, which plummeted during the housing crisis. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer. Marketplace.
There is a long tradition in the American military of soldiers and sailors inscribing personal messages on their weapons, whether it's tanks or airplanes or the bombs that they drop. That is, soldiers doing the inscribing, not manufacturers, which is why the Pentagon is scrambling to decide what to do about some gun sights that it's been buying for the Army and the Marine Corps. The sights work well enough. It's what's on them, what is written on them, that's the problem. Shorthand references to passages in the New Testament, like JN 8:12 for John chapter 8, verse 12. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
The Military Religious Freedom Foundation says service members fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan started complaining about the gun sites a few weeks ago. They're supplied under a $660 million contract by Michigan-based Trigicon, which identifies itself as Christian and faith-based, the foundation's Mikey Weinstein.
To find these biblical references actually engraved into the gun sights on our M4s and M16s is beyond the pale.
Weinstein says they also violate military rules against proselytizing in the Middle East. An Army spokesman said the scriptural gun sights aren't a problem because they're for American soldiers, not Afghans or Iraqis who might be offended, and he said even the U.S. currency mentions God. Weinstein scoffs at that.
It says, in God we trust. It doesn't say, in Jesus we trust.
Cabrini College business professor Scott Testa says using Christianity in marketing isn't unusual, though doing it on military weapons is.
You'll have everything from real estate agents, insurance agents, retailers, where they'll actually quote scriptures in their marketing materials.
The Marines say they're reviewing the contract with Trigicon, as is the British government, which also bought gun sites with citations from the Gospels and Revelations. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Tom Mann and I were talking a couple of minutes ago about what Democrats may or may not be able to get done now that Republicans have 41 votes in the Senate. To that list, you have to add the president's proposed tax on banks. He wants them to help make sure that TARP, the bank bailout, doesn't cost taxpayers any more money. Commentator David Frum understands that part. It's the tax part he doesn't agree with.
When and if we recover from this recession, we are going to have to worry about government debt and deficits. Spending cuts and tax increases will become the priorities of politics. President Obama just gave us a good example of how not to do it. The president has endorsed a tax on banks by size to collect a projected $90 billion over the next 10 years. The president argues that the tax will help repay taxpayer losses in the TARP bailout program for banks. It's a crummy argument. Most of the TARP losses will be racked up not at banks, but at the AIG insurance company and the rescued automakers, GM and Chrysler. No tax for them. Meanwhile, banks that receive not a dime from TARP will be taxed. I get it that people want to punish banks. Banks lobby to change laws to allow them to undertake riskier activities. Then, when the risks went bad, they begged for public money to rescue themselves. They got it, too, and now they are paying their top people huge bonuses to thank them for profits really owed to public generosity. So the desire to punish is understandable, but punishment is a bad basis for taxation. The new tax won't be applied to bonus pools. It will be applied to banks by asset size, meaning based on the amount of lending they do. But, of course, the big problem of the moment is that banks are not lending nearly enough. How does it make sense to punish banks for doing more of what we should want them to do? It's true that the huge expansion of government undertaken by President Obama will have to be financed to the extent it cannot be rolled back. That financing ought to be done as rationally as possible. It should preserve incentives to work, save, and invest. It should avoid favoring or disfavoring specific industries. It should be cheap to collect. And it should be enacted jointly with reductions in government spending. President Obama's bank tax flunks on every count.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Do take a moment and share your thoughts with us. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, softening the pain of poverty.
You know, I always was teased because of the clothes I wore. It wasn't the best clothes. It wasn't the best shoes. So I always told myself, I'm going to strive to do better. I'm going to strive to have more.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial slumped 1.1% today, 122 points, closed at 10,603. The NASDAQ flopped 1.25%, 29 points, 22.91. The S&P 500 slid 1%, 12 points, ended at 1138. Bank of America reported a heavy loss today, but the company still managed to claw back more than 1%. U.S. Bancorp popped up more than 2% today. Goldman Sachs raked in a 0.5% gain today ahead of its earnings release tomorrow. Can you say bonuses? The New York Times lost more than 2.75% today after it announced a possible plan to get online readers to pay for its content. Starbucks cooled 1.2% today ahead of its earnings. Shanghai's composite exchange led Asian and European markets lower, crumbled 3%. Hong Kong's Hang Seng fell nearly 2% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. You can build a team online at elance.com. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace State Book, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, a House committee discusses safety standards for infant cribs. The U.S. Conference of Mayors continues with a gathering at the White House. The mayors meet with President Obama and his economic advisory team. And the curtain opens on the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. In addition to hot new films, the 1971 classic Harold and Maude gets some screen time. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The price of a ton of carbon lost some ground in the European carbon markets today. They actually have a climate exchange over there where companies can buy and sell the right to pollute, in essence. Europe has what is called a cap-and-trade system. Greenhouse gas emissions are capped, that is limited. And then those pollution credits become a tradable commodity between industries that need them and companies that have pollution to spare. Cap and trade is one of the big linchpins of climate policy, using the market to control the amount of carbon in the atmosphere. But of course, the reality is not even remotely so simple. In this month's Harper's Magazine, Mark Shapiro spent some time trying to figure out how you verify those carbon credits. Mark, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
The cap and trade regime has two purposes. One is actually functioning as a market. The other side of the coin, though, is the questionable part, whether or not it actually does really reduce carbon emissions.
Yes. Let me give you an example. Mm-hmm. You have a major German utility which monitors the emissions at every one of their utilities all around Germany. And every month, that company knows exactly how much over their emission cap they're going. And so whenever they reach that cap, they know they have to go buy 5 million tons, 10 million tons, 50 million tons, 100 million tons of these things called credits.
And when they need those credits, they go to Brazil or some other developing economy where some entrepreneur has set up a system whereby he can promise reductions in emission, yes?
Yes. So that utility can then look to a developing country like Brazil or China or India to find a project where a developer is saying, all right, you know, I would have been emitting X amount of methane, for example, but I'm going to put in a little machine that's going to capture the methane from the landfill, and therefore I'm going to reduce my emissions by X percent.
He gets the credits for it, and then he sells that to the German utility, and everybody's happy, yes?
Exactly.
Okay, so here's what has always stumped me about a possible cap and trade market mechanism. It's not like you're buying and selling a pound of pork bellies here. You have this amorphous thing, this unit of carbon. It's a unit of air, as your piece talks about it. And you explain in your piece that the United Nations has set up a verification mechanism. Tell us about that.
Yeah, my piece explores who are the people that are doing these measurements and how reliable are these measurements. They are like the carbon accountants. They are the ratings agencies that we saw in Wall Street that assess the value of publicly traded companies. Well, the same kind of process occurs with carbon. And what's happened, for example, is two of the biggest of those rating agencies were actually suspended by the United Nations because of what the United Nations determined was inadequate oversight of the audits that they had conducted and inadequate technical skill levels of the people who work for them.
Where does this leave us then with the United States possibly getting into this market and yet the underlying premise of measuring the carbon credits not being entirely reliable? I mean, what happens next? Because, I mean, this was the thing that was going to save the planet, right?
This was the thing that was going to save the planet. The cap and trade system was largely designed by the United States as a way to detour around this idea of a carbon tax. So now the rest of the world was left to execute this plan, of course, when the United States left Kyoto in 2001. Now we're about to jump in. Where this leaves us is a very serious debate over how are you going to oversee this market. For example, is it going to be the Securities Exchange Commission, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the people who regulate utilities? And how much regulation is there going to be to ensure that the emissions that are promised are actually delivered?
Mark Shapiro, he's a senior correspondent at the Center for Investigative Reporting. His piece in Harper's Magazine this month about carbon trade and cap and trade and all that is called Conning the Climate. Mark, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
There are, according to the United States Census, almost 40 million people living in poverty in this country. A lot of them are stuck in what's called generational poverty, where decade after decade, families have grown up poor. Research shows that if you're born poor, there is an even chance you're going to die poor. And the Great Recession is making it more difficult for people to break that cycle. Stephen Smith from American Radio Works reports now on the long, hard climb out of poverty.
Biggie. Oh, here. You have two slices of pizza in the microwave.
Biggie Williams and Russell Brockman are friends who met at a work training program in Minneapolis. They like to hang out, play dominoes, and drink and eat. Both men say they are determined to leave their past lives behind.
I never wanted that the life I had.
This is Biggie Williams.
All my life I've been in a single-parent home. You know, I always was teased because of the clothes I wore. It wasn't the best clothes. It wasn't the best shoes. So I always told myself, I'm going to strive to do better. I'm going to strive to have more.
Biggie is 22 years old, and he lives up to his name. He's big, 6 feet tall and more than 300 pounds. Russell's even bigger and older. Russell is 44, a product of Chicago and that city's notorious street gangs. Russell Brockman spent nearly half his adult life in prison or committing crimes.
Prior to a year ago, you wouldn't want to know me. I was not a nice guy. I mean, I was a drug dealer, I was mean. Unless you was offering me drugs or sex or money, I didn't really want nothing to do with you.
A year ago, Russell decided to quit the criminal life. As he entered middle age, Russell says he got tired of always watching his back and that he wanted to become a better and more productive person. That's when Russell heard about a local anti-poverty project called Twin Cities Rise, which helps chronically unemployed people land well-paying jobs with benefits. Peggy Houston runs the nonprofit agency. She says that most students take at least a year to learn the skills and the attitude they need to get a job.
We have to work at giving them a lot of confidence and helping them be sure of themselves as they go out into this world. And we do it by setting some pretty high standards here.
Standards like a dress code, a strict attendance policy, and drug testing.
And we say to them, we're just like the employer out there, and you have to meet those standards. If you're successful here, you will be successful when you leave here.
RISE students learn so-called soft skills, like punctuality, discipline, and professional behavior. These are lessons that are common in middle-class schools and communities, less so when you grow up poor. When a student is ready, he or she gets a paid internship at a local small business or a big corporation. It's like a starter job to get used to the work world.
Three boxes, one bag, two pictures. One here, the light's open.
Russell and Biggie both interned at the warehouse of a Twin Cities nonprofit that gives furniture to people in need.
There's a footstool in 317.
Anything else on the roof?
Kitchen table.
Biggie and Russell made a great impression at the internship. The founder of the warehouse, Fran Heitzman, watched Russell heave a big oak table onto a waiting semi-truck and marveled at his work ethic.
I've been in business all my life, hired people all my life, and that's a good one there. Anybody gets him on his workforce, they got a gem.
But sometimes a gem has deep flaws. Biggie tells what happened to Russell.
He was in the back of the warehouse picking up some items for a pickup. and saw or heard the police up front and left out the back door.
Turns out that Russell had robbed a Minneapolis bank the day before. Police matched his handprint on the bank counter to his criminal record, then tracked him down. Biggie couldn't understand why Russell did it, especially since they had just been paid for their internship.
The thing that just keeps going through my head, he had money. He had money in his hand. Why would he need to do that? For what?
The fact is that escaping a life of poverty often means trying to escape other problems, like addiction. When you live close to the edge your whole life, it's that much easier to fall.
Well, I was waiting on the bus. A prostitute walked up to me. And she looked damn good. So we went to the liquor store, went to somebody's house, and had alcohol and sex and crack cocaine. And after it was all gone, I left. I was trying to go home, but I was still very high, and the craving just got the best of me. I said, go in that bank. And
the cravings got the best of you, so you went to the bank.
Yep.
Russell blames himself for what he calls a stupid decision, and he pleaded guilty to the bank robbery. He expects to go back to prison for maybe up to 20 years. Meanwhile, Biggie Williams recently got promoted to a full-time job at the warehouse. Giving out furniture to poor folks reminds Biggie of the days when he slept on a cold floor with no blanket. He's determined not to drift back to his old life.
This situation I'm in right now, I've been working on it for a year or so now, and it's looking up. Everything's starting to move in a better direction, so I'm not going to stop now. I'm not letting it derail me now.
Optimism helps, because turning around a life lived in poverty is typically slow and difficult. Of the nearly 100 unemployed people who started at Twin Cities Rise with Biggie Williams and Russell Brockman, most were still in the program a year later. So far, six of them have reached that hard-won goal, full-time jobs. In Minneapolis, this is Stephen Smith for Marketplace.
A note of disclosure about our story today. The founder of Twin Cities Rise also sits on the board of directors of our parent company, American Public Media. There is a link to our documentary about people trying to get out of poverty on our homepage. And while you're there, you can test your knowledge about minimum wage with our new online feature, The Daily Nugget. It's gone. Our website is marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, Google has a cell phone out now, as you may know. So Apple is thinking about changing the way it does search. Seems Apple is in talks with Microsoft to make Bing the default search engine on the iPhone. That'll cost Google some money in ad search revenue, so I suppose you could call that the marketplace angle. But really, it's more interesting just as an example of how petty two ginormous companies can actually get. And with that, nothing more about Apple until the 27th, I promise, when it either comes out with or does not come out with that new tablet thing that everybody's been talking about. That, on this Wednesday, is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow down 122 points, 1.1%. The NASDAQ off 29 points, 1.25%. The S&P 500 dipped 12 points, 1%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And next time on this radio broadcast, keeping costs low for union workers.
A root canal is $20. X-rays, cleanings are free. Fillings are $3. A denture is $85.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.